This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Yesterday, Bank of America ditched a plan to charge its customers $5 a month to use their debit cards. This follows on the heels of similar decisions by J.P. Morgan Chase and Wells Fargo. Consumer advocates are claiming victory, and while they may have won a battle, the war between big banks and consumers rages on. A Facebook-based campaign has declared Saturday as Bank Transfer Day. Supporters are urging consumers to move their deposits from big banks to credit unions and smaller community banks. It's another sign of a continuing frustration that millions of Americans feel toward the financial industry. So today we'll take a look at the role banks and credit unions play in our personal lives and the larger economy. Is moving our money to credit unions the answer? Did the 2008 financial meltdown result in real reform of the banking industry? And what would it take to get money flowing into the economy again? Joining me by phone from Charlotte is Rick Rothacker. He covers banks for Reuters and is the author of Banktown, The Rise and Struggles of Charlotte's Big Banks. Also on the line, Stacy Mitchell. She's a senior researcher with the New Rules Project. It's a program of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. And with me in the studio is Randy Chambers. He's president of Self-Help Credit Union based in Durham. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you on the program.
Thanks.
So I should tell you, by the way, that we invited Bank of America, Wells Fargo, the North Carolina Bankers Association, and the American Bankers Association to join the conversation. None would make a representative available. So that leaves room for you at 877-962-9862. Call us or send us an email at sot@wnc.org. Are you rethinking where you keep your money? How has your customer service and experience been with a community bank or a credit union? Has it been different than a major bank? Give us a call. Rick Rothacker, let me start with you and the news. How did Bank of America explain yesterday's announcement to back off that debit card fee?
Well, the explanation they gave is that they were reacting to the customer feedback they'd been getting, which everyone I think is well aware of, and the competitive landscape, which goes to the point that they were sort of the last man standing with a debit card fee. A lot of the other banks had started pulling out last week, and they were really kind of the last one.
Now, you talked about the fact just now that other banks had done this. They've all pulled back. First of all, what prompted the big banks to consider those charges in the first place?
Well, it goes back to the Dodd-Frank legislation, which was passed last year, and it included a provision that basically ended up cutting in half the revenue they would make when you go to the retailer or to a merchant and swipe your card. The merchant would pay a fee to the banks, which was pretty lucrative, and that was basically getting cut down. And so the banks were trying to figure out a way to make up this revenue they were losing, and what they came up with was these sort of monthly fees for using your debit card.
They were losing revenue on that end. They thought they'd come up with fees on this end. Let's get a big picture of the revenue story with banks, because it comes at a time when Bank of America is looking to lay off as many as 30,000 workers, and yet Bank of America also proposed a dividend increase for shareholders, proposed that anyway. Mr. Moynihan changed his idea about that. Laying off workers, increasing dividends. How healthy is Bank of America?
Well, it's having a tough times right now. They are working through all their mortgage liabilities, which came with the countrywide financial purchase, and there's still a lot of work to be done on that end. They did have third quarter results, which had a lot of kind of one-time issues in there, but it was kind of received well that maybe they were starting to turn a corner. But essentially with the cost cutting, they're saying, you know, we're not making enough revenue to support the costs we have. So they're trying to improve profits by cutting back. Earlier in the year, they were hoping to do, like you said, you know, it would have been, I think, a very modest dividend increase. And they've got a lot of shareholders who have had some pretty tough times with their stock lately, and they're only getting 1 cent dividend per share each quarter. They thought about trying to raise that a little bit, and the Federal Reserve basically said, you know, you need to kind of hold on to your capital and work through some other things first. So that was sort of an embarrassment for the CEO.
Well, it is an interesting decision. If on the one hand you're saying, you know, we're just not that ready yet we can't afford all these employees, yet we can afford the dividend. It was a bit of a contradiction, I suppose, at least to outside observers.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's you know, on one hand, companies are always trying to please their shareholders, which means, you know, producing more profits and returning some of that. And at the same time, you're trying to, you know, hold on to your employees and you know, help the overall economy with that employment.
Stacy Mitchell, your website, the New Rules Project, advocates that consumers put their money into credit unions rather than banks. Why is that?
Well, actually, we advocate that consumers put their money into local financial institutions, so both community banks and credit unions. We think that it's really about putting your money to work in your community and in your local economy. It's quite a dramatic difference when you begin to look at what it is that big banks do with your money. A fair amount of it is, speculation in securities trading and Wall Street type activities. Some of it is lent to big corporations that, have done more to lay people off in recent years than they have to increase employment. In contrast, what we found is that in general, locally owned banks and credit unions are putting your money to work in your local economy. I think some of the most compelling statistics, really, to move your money local is when you look at small business lending. And what we have found in pulling some of this bank data is that, the largest 20 banks in this country have almost 60% of all the bank assets, and yet they do only about a quarter of all the small business lending. And it's reversed for community banks. If you look at small and mid-sized community banks, they have about a quarter of all bank assets, but they do almost 60% of all small business lending. And that really, I think, goes right to the story of part of what's going on with our economy right now is the credit that small businesses need. And a lot of what's holding that back has been consolidation in the banking industry and the growth of these giant institutions.
Randy, maybe you can help explain some of that if it's true. You're the president of a credit union, self-help based here in Durham. Is that true? Are you just in a better position to make more of those kind of loans that keep the money in the community?
Well, I think the thing that's unique about us or about another credit union or community bank is that really 100% of what we do is in a local community. We don't have branches across the nation. We have branches across the state. A community bank might have 3-4 bank branches in town. And so really, we're going to make loans to people who come into our branches. We know the local economy. So we know if someone says, I want to open up a restaurant in downtown Durham, whether there's demand for a restaurant in downtown Durham. We have a pretty good sense of that. So I think a local credit union or community bank is just – it's similar to the choice between going to a locally owned hardware store or food market versus shopping at a chain. Most of us do both. If you're putting your money in a self-help credit union or a Harrington Bank here in the Triangle area, that money's most likely to be lent out here because that's where we are. That's not to say that the big banks don't make loans in our communities. But clearly, it's really our hallmark as a local institution is making loans here locally because we know the community.
What's the difference? Maybe, Stacy, I'll put this question to you, although, Randy, I'm sure you can answer it as well. The difference between a credit union and a commercial bank?
Well, a credit union is owned by its members, and, it must operate in a way that's, it doesn't make a profit. Any kind of profit it makes is repaid in dividends back to its members or goes back into the credit union. One nice thing about that is that as a member, you have a little bit of a decision-making role in the bank or the credit union, I should say, and it can't be bought by a larger institution without you as a member voting to allow that to happen. Banks, community banks are also locally owned and very focused on the community, but it's a private model. It's a little bit different. They do tend to do a bit more small business lending than credit unions tend to focus more on consumer loans. But either way, I think the kind of focus is on the community.
Rick Rothiger, I want to take one step back and take a look at this growing protest movement. You talk with bankers every day. You cover the industry. How do bankers feel about this backlash? Are they feeling that this is a little unfair? They're feeling put upon? They're not really the villain? We should look somewhere else?
I think there's a little bit of a mixture. I mean, on one hand, I think some of them feel like, they've been kind of beat up here for 3 years now. That they feel like they've kind of taken their punishment and maybe are getting more than their share. But I think there are folks who do recognize, that the economy, they're certainly well aware the economy is not turning around very quickly and that people are suffering. So I think they try to be cognizant of that. there's a wide spectrum of bankers. I mean, you've got, you know, CEOs making millions and millions, and you've got, you know, smaller, you know, bankers at smaller smaller institutions that, you know, they're going to feel, you know, maybe everyone shouldn't be lumped in together. So I think there's kind of a mixed feeling, but I think there are some who feel like they do good things for the community and that maybe they're getting beat up too much.
And clearly they are feeling the pressure. Do you think, and have you heard, that this movement has taken them by surprise, but they are indeed responding to the protests that we're seeing on the streets and that they're hearing, you know, in their offices?
I think so. I mean, you see this response with the debit fees being dropped. I mean, they're saying this is directly to customer feedback, and certainly when you talk to the consumer groups, you know, they feel like they had an impact. And we were talking to Occupy Wall Street folks yesterday and talking to community groups, and I think even some of the community organizations are surprised by, you know, they've seen a lot of people mad about fees and things like that over the years, and this one really kind of just really struck a nerve and I think took off. And you look at Bank of America, I mean, they introduced this fee essentially, or words first started getting out about this at the end of September, and only 1 month later they're the last to back off.
Well, we're going to continue this conversation on the state of things with Rick Rothacker from Reuters, Stacy Mitchells from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance, and Randy Chambers, president of the Durham-based Self-Help Credit Union. And we'll start taking your phone calls as well, 877-962-9862. When we come back, how much has changed since 2008? We'll talk about it on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're taking a look at banks, credit unions, best place to put your money. And we asked the question in light of a movement to urge Americans to transfer their money out of big banks and into credit unions and smaller community banks. With me by phone from Charlotte is Rick Rothacker. He covers banks for Reuters. He's the author of Banktown, The Rise and Struggles of Charlotte's Big Banks. Also on the line, Stacy Mitchell, a senior researcher with the New Rules Project. With me in the studio is Randy Chambers, president of Self-Help Credit Union in Durham. And joining me now on the phone, Sally Omarova. She is an assistant professor of law at UNC, and she specializes in financial regulations. Looking for your phone calls, too, 877-962-9862. You can tell us your experience with financial institutions, if you banked with a credit union or a community bank, how it goes with commercial banks, and some of the bigger questions about your conscience and where you think your money should go. Give us a call at 877-962-9862. Sally, a lot of this consumer anger began with the meltdown in 2008. Taxpayer money used to bail out a number of financial institutions. There was a call for reform. Do you think the reform that was enacted went far enough?
It's a difficult question because Dodd-Frank is a voluminous law, and of course it purports to make many, many changes. But in reality, that statute does not address the fundamental problem that we've had before the crisis and that led to the crisis. And that problem is the fact that we have this huge financial conglomerates, not only big financial institutions, but also diversified financial institutions that engage in banking and securities, insurance underwriting, derivatives trading and dealing, and a whole array of activities that in effect make them dealers in financial risk, pure financial risk. And we still have those institutions. And as a matter of fact, after the bailout and the failure of some of them, now we have a fewer number of bigger institutions that are too big to fail. And unfortunately, the Dodd-Frank Act does not change the fact that those institutions are able to engage in highly risky and risk-generating complex financial transactions and deal in financial risk in the same way they did before the crisis, and yet be attached to the federal subsidy, the FDIC insurance and access to the Federal Reserve as a lender of last resort, all of that stuff that makes them sort of so important that should they come down, we would have to bail them out again.
Well, I thought
so
one
that
of the,
part,
forgive me for interrupting, but I did think one of the things Dodd-Frank did was replace that all-important provision that was in Glass-Steagall that said financial that commercial banks could not engage in the same kind of activity as investment banks, that wall that had come down was one of the most important factors that led to the crash, and we're going to put that back up. Didn't it go back in?
No, it did not. What happened in 1999 with Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act was that it allowed to affiliate commercial banks and investment banks and insurance companies and a whole bunch of other types of institutions, create those diversified conglomerates. And you're absolutely right. That was one of the structural reasons that enabled this type of financial speculation, because of the attachment to ultimately the FDIC and other forms of public subsidy. The walls that you're talking about are probably the Volcker Rule, right?
Yeah.
That's
in Dodd-Frank, right.
Yes. That is... It sounds quite lofty, but in reality, that rule focuses on proprietary trading. And proprietary trading is very difficult to define, but essentially it is trading on the banks on account as an investor, right? If I'm investing in the securities because I think the securities will go up in value, that's why I'm buying them. That is very different from what large institutions do as dealers, market makers. They don't care if the market goes up or down. All they care about is that they have a large enough portfolio and clients on both sides, you know, and they make fees off of that. Now, that is explicitly accepted from the prohibition of the Volcker Rule, and that essentially leaves a huge hole in the ability of these financial institutions to take risk, to create risk, and to enable market players that are not themselves banks, hedge funds, insurance companies, whoever they are.
Right, especially if you're betting both ways. So you can make a loan to a company, and if for some reason that company goes south and you bet that it's going to go south, you win either way. And that's kind of part of that was AIG's problem. And you're saying that's still allowed. And the other problem, I guess, is that bank subsidiaries are allowed to engage in these kind of things. And so the connection there is a little bit dicey and a little shadowy still. Is that right?
Well, the Volcker Rule actually defines the banking entity as affiliates and subsidiaries and the holding company of the bank. So the entire bank holding company structure is picked up technically by the Volcker Rule prohibition on proprietary trading. However, like I said, because of these exemptions that are in the statute for market making, also for hedging, for example, certain risks, those two exemptions by themselves essentially leave the dealing business of these financial institutions intact. So, in effect, the Volcker Rule is, in my opinion anyway, in reality, in practice, is going to be a far weaker wall, to the extent it is a wall, than it purports to be. And that's very important to understand.
Let's go to the phones right now. Robert is in Pleasant Grove. Robert, do you have a comment for us or a question?
Yes, hello. My comment actually is just that I think one of the most effective ways to sort of re-regulate the banking system is, being that our money system is a debt-based money system and that money is created as debts, along the lines of Dennis Kucinich has passed a bill in the last two Congresses called the NEED Act. it was 6550 in the first one, and I think that the last one was 2990. But essentially what it purports to do is to change the way that the money is created, which, you know, if you read the bill and go into it, which I'm probably not qualified really to get too far into, but it seems to me that that would actually take away a lot of the perverse incentives that banking has gotten to be in things like if somebody saw an inside job or some good accounts, I think, of just how crazy this system is and the problems that we as Americans face are kind of caused by this nebulous banking system and this monetary system, which is in itself wrong. And people have been working on these solutions since the Depression. And I just think that it would be good for people to catch wind of that and discuss that as an actual alternative rather than, you know, just petty ante little regulation changes here and there.
Well, let's get some ideas about that. Thank you for calling, Robert. Stacy Mitchell, I think the idea is that the whole way the financial structure, including lending money into the economy, which then immediately costs you money, is part of the problem. Is it a question, Stacy Mitchell, of scale, of size, that is, in a sense, part of the problem here? Things have just gotten too big.
I think that's absolutely true. You have institutions that are, you know, too big to fail, and one of the things that has done is that they, you know, these larger financial institutions have enormous clout within the economy, but they also have enormous political clout. And that means in many respects they have rigged the rules in their favor. I think if you know, I can't speak to some of the things that the caller was talking about with this particular bill, but I think if you look at the Federal Reserve's policy, you will see, you know, a lot of examples and ways in which our monetary policy really favors giant banks and undermines community institutions. I mean, it's been a very difficult few years for community-based banks and credit unions, you know, because of some of the policies that have been implemented to help the big banks. And that's really unfortunate because they're the institutions that are in the best position to help the economy grow, and they're the institutions that didn't cause this mess in the first place.
Randy Chambers, how about that? I mean, are the rules stacked? Do you think it's too difficult for credit unions to do the work that you'd like to do?
I think that it's a balancing act. Regulation is always a balancing act. There are certain things that regulators should be encouraging us to do, and there are certain things that regulators should be discouraging us to do. I think, unfortunately, what happened leading up to 2008 is in the previous 10 to 15 years, really, the Federal Reserve in particular and Chairman Greenspan really did have this view that the market would rule and the market would lead to prudent business decisions. And we saw in 2007 and 2008 that wasn't the case. So there are a lot of things that are in the Dodd-Frank bill that are actually very good for consumers and very good for the economy. So, for example, the types of subprime loans that really started the crisis in the middle of the last decade have basically been outlawed by Dodd-Frank. Dodd-Frank's also established a Consumer Protection Financial Protection Bureau, which is the first time in American history that we have a financial regulator who has an obligation to ensure that financial institutions are doing things that are actually good for people. So I think there are some good regulations that have come out as a result of this, but I think there's also a fear amongst regulators is you don't want to be the person running the FDIC or the Federal Reserve when the next Washington Mutual collapses. And so you react to the last crisis. And I think there's a piece of what's gone on with regulation that has impacted everything from a church-based credit union that's run by volunteers and has 300 customers to a Bank of America where we say one size fits all. And I think that's the unfortunate part is that regulators tend to swing with a very heavy bat and they may squash some of us who weren't involved in the crisis and creating the crisis. So I think it's a balancing act on regulation.
Can you give me an example of that kind of a regulation that was put in place that sort of you feel in a sense ties your hands? You might be able to do some good.
You know, it's hard. I'd have to think a little bit about that. I mean, I think there have always been one-size-fits-all regulations that don't make a lot of sense. So, for example, a small credit union that might only serve people who work at a local tire factory has to have the same rules about ensuring that its clients, our customers, aren't sending money to finance terrorists overseas as a major multinational bank like Citi, which actually has branches throughout the world. So that's one of kind of our pet peeves is that you have this one size fits all that is really critical. You know, large banks have been either generally unknowingly involved in allowing money to be wired out overseas to terrorists, but then we decide that all, you know, 20,000 U.S. federal depositories have to have that same regulation. So I think the lack of nuance in that sort of regulation concerns that credit unions might be taking too much risk in making home loans to local residents because banks lost money on making home loans to local residents. It just tends to be a one-size-fits-all approach.
Rick Rothiker, do you hear concerns about bankers? You cover the industry. What do they think of Dodd-Frank now that it's been in place for a while?
Yeah, I think it's been, you know, not real well embraced at the big banks or the little banks. I mean, I think you hear the same kind of criticisms from community banks that they're, you know, they're kind of suffering for the sins of the larger banks, and it's, you know, much more expensive proportionally for them to add more compliance people and things like that. And then, you know, certainly large banks and the trade groups, you know, are front and center saying, you know, if we're overregulated and have to hold on to too much capital, you know, that could have an impact on the economy because we've got less money to lend out. So I think there is some pushback. You also, you know, I've heard concerns about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that sort of another regulator to get into their business and tell them how to run, you know, provide products. Although some of the banks, including Bank of America, did come out in support of the agency, you know, there's still a lot of kind of pushback against that as well.
Let's go back to the phones. Desiree is on the line from Franklinton. Hello, Desiree.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to share a little bit of a part of our story, which I know a lot of people could probably relate to. Back in 2007, my husband went to Wachovia, which is now Wells Fargo, to get our mortgage. And they had encouraged him to take a higher mortgage than he wanted. He was smart enough not to do that because we were a one-income family at that time. However, they proceeded to continue to sell him other products like personal loans, credit cards, and unfortunately, we did get two of those. And today, here we are, and not able to pay them. And my point is that the bank had to look at his income and know that we were not going to be able to repay those loans. And so sure enough, here we are. And, you know, we are very much wanting to pay our debt back. And so I'm working with them, have been trying to work with them to pay back our debt on monthly payments to get caught up. And what my husband's father died about a month ago, we went to Florida to go, you know, bury him and do all that. Because I had not set up one monthly payment, even though I had been making regular payments for like 8 months, they took every dollar my husband got paid. They took $1,400 out of our bank account and left us with $1. And my point is that when you deal with these bigger banks and you get your mortgage and your loan and other things through them, they have the right, if you don't pay them, they can empty your bank account. And so my point when I called them was like, you know, you guys, we take responsibility in getting ourselves into debt that we shouldn't have, and we plan to change that and work on that. But the banks also need to take some responsibility back before the crisis happened, in that they were just throwing loans and money out to people, and they don't take any responsibility for that. They still want their money.
Desiree, thank you for that. It gets to the business plan, the business model for banking, commercial for-profit banks versus a nonprofit credit union. Self-help is in the business of making subprime loans. That's exactly what self-help was doing. Responsible self-help loans, subprime loans that were being paid back significantly. Self-help didn't go under during the crisis. In fact, expanded somewhat. Randy, how is that possible? How were you making loans to people who on paper weren't good credit risks, but not losing them or your business, and the big banks did? What's the difference in the model?
Well, I think that there is a difference in the model in that we don't have earnings pressure. Every quarter, we don't have to report to our stockholders how much money we made. We do have to report to our regulators that we're financially healthy, so we have to make loans that are prudent. And so our balance is generally between prudence and impact in the community. And so for us, we've had a long time philosophy that if you give a working class person the opportunity to buy a home to a borrower whose credit is less than a typical, you know, good credit borrower, that they'll do pretty much anything they can to stay in that home. It's where they want to raise their children. It allows them to go to the same schools year after year, to participate in PTAs. The impacts of people owning a home in terms of their self-esteem and their commitment to their community is pretty substantial. But that said, you can only make loans to people who can afford to pay it. And I think the caller gives an example of where the banks basically said, if I keep lending money, somebody else, the next bank will probably bail me out when this person can't pay. And so it became a vicious cycle that in order to meet short-term quarterly earnings goals, they were pushing money out the door. And in our case, we felt like slow and steady wins the game.
But in a sense, you're saying that your business model was based on the business of making good loans, whereas a bank can actually turn a profit and make bad loans. And that's, it seems to me that fundamentally, someone who's not an economist or a banker, there's something wrong with that incentive in that particular place.
And I think that's in some ways that was the genesis of Dodd-Frank. And in particular, the consumer protections put on mortgage lending and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, basically saying, we as an American public, we are guaranteeing the banks. They are government-sponsored corporations because when they fail, the FDIC pays for it. And grant the FDIC assesses fees to banks to do that. But if ultimately the FDIC fails, just as the Savings and Loans Insurance Fund failed 20 years ago, the taxpayer ends up bailing them out. So I think what we said is if you're going to have taxpayer protection, you have an obligation to protect the taxpayer who is the consumer user. And so I hear what Rick says, and I hear that from banks as well, that there are things that Dodd-Frank may have gone overboard on. But in some ways, the big banks invited this on themselves, and really the investment banks more than anything who provided the liquidity to the banks to make bad loans, brought this upon the American economy. And so to then say, okay, we're not going to let you do this again. We're going to make sure that you are protecting the interests of communities and only making loans that people can afford to pay is not an unreasonable request for us to make of financial institutions that have a government guarantee.
And Stacy Mitchell, I guess this is what you're getting at when you talk about looking at institutions that focus on the local community.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, the point the caller raises is, you know, one of the model of many of these big banks is really has been to securitize loans. So they, you know, they sell you, they make you, you know, a consumer a bad loan and then package it up and sell it off to investors. And so they're not going to make money over the long term on the interest. What they're going to make money on is all the fees they earn in doing that. And so they don't really care at the end of the day whether that mortgage is good or that consumer loan is going to be paid back. And that was the model that drove really this whole crisis in a lot of ways. It's very different from a community bank or a credit union where, by and large, most of the loans that they make stay on their books. I mean, and they their own health really depends on the health of the local economy. So the last thing they want is a bunch of people in the community losing their houses or, you know, having other kinds of defaults.
All right, Stacy, we're going to take a break right now. Our conversation about banks and where you should put your money continues on The State of Things. We're going to take your calls at 877-962-9862 when our program continues in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio talking about where to put your money. My guests are Rick Rothacker, covers banking for Reuters, author of Banktown, The Rise and Struggles of Charlotte's Big Banks. Stacy Mitchell is a senior researcher with the New Rules Project, a program of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Randy Chambers is here, president of Self-Help Credit Union based in Durham. And Sally Omarova is an assistant professor of law at UNC who specializes in financial regulations. We're taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. When it comes to regulation, Sally, we talked about the rules that are in place, some good, maybe some not strong enough. There was some controversy just a while back over TARP repayments. When the banks got the bailout money, there were some rules attached. The sooner they paid that off, the sooner they were out from under the rules. But the money was there so that they would become more stable. They wanted to pay back quickly so they didn't have to abide by the rules. And the regulators who were overseeing that repayment said, okay, we're going to waive the restrictions and let you repay early. On the one hand, they paid back the money. Good news. On the other hand, they weren't quite ready and regulators waived the rules. So does it raise questions about whether or not we can even trust that the regulations in place are going to be strictly enforced?
So in other words, this is a question of do we trust our regulators,
financial regulators, to do it?
And it's, again, this is a complicated question. But regulators operate under a variety of incentives. And in the financial sector, it is a known fact that the relationship between the regulators and the industry is very close, and it's good in some ways, right? Because it gives the regulator an insight into what's going on in the industry and enhances the regulator's ability to supervise on a day-to-day basis pretty much the business of big banks. But on the other hand, it creates this ability for the industry to put its views in front of the regulator every day, and in many ways it allows the big banks to convince the regulator that the big banks know better what's going on and they know better what needs to be done. And this sort of intellectual capture, if you will, of financial regulators is a very it's an insidious thing, and unfortunately there have been a lot of examples of that dynamics taking place in the decades before the crisis, and to this day it's going on. So I think we should trust regulators, but not entirely. I think there is an important work to be done in terms of how to structure how our regulators work with the industry.
Do you have a sense, Rick Rothiger, let me put the question to you and let you speculate just a minute. What should the model be? Is there a sense, even among bankers, about what they would like to see in terms of a level playing ground, a level playing field, something everybody understands but also allows them to move ahead in their business of banking? What would that model look like?
Well, obviously everyone's still trying to work through that. I think, although there was criticism of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, one thing that some of the banks said as a positive of that is that maybe that would create a level playing field, in the sense that when you go back and look at some of the kind of the worst excesses of the mortgage bubble, it was the less regulated companies, the Countrywides and sort of the pure mortgage companies that maybe were lowering their standards faster than banks, and which kind of creates a race to the bottom. And so if there is a Consumer Protection Bureau that kind of lays out some national mortgage standards, that could be a positive for borrowers, of course, and potentially maybe helps the more regulated banks to kind of compete with everyone else out there. That would potentially be a benefit, but obviously there is some, they are pushing back on, having their business prescribed to them.
I want to go back to the phones now. April is on the line from Hullocksville. Hello, April. Do you have a comment or a question for us?
Yes, thank you. I have a comment. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to compliment groups like Self-Help and Community Lending Banks. My partner and I, we started a letterpress studio in Pollocksville, and when we approached the commercial lenders, we were turned away, and we were unable to apply for a startup loan. But when we went to the North Carolina Rural Center, we were accepted and able to work through everything. They set us up with a repayment plan that was workable for our budget, and it allowed us to start our business and be able to grow, and things are going really well. So just thank you to groups like Self-Help and for stimulating the economy and allowing us to realize our dreams and change things for individuals that want to start their own businesses.
And April, what is the North Carolina Rural Center? It's not a bank, is it?
No, the North Carolina Rural Center is through the state of North Carolina, and it is they have microloans, and so we were able to apply for a microloan.
Oh, thank you for the call, Stacy. 877-96, or April, I should say. I want to go to Stacy next, because Stacy Mitchell, while the Rural Center is not a state-owned bank, it's obviously a state-funded agency. North Dakota has an example of an actual state-owned bank that works pretty well. I know that's an example you point to frequently.
Yeah, it's a very interesting model, and one that a growing number of states around the country are now looking at replicating. The Bank of North Dakota is not a regular retail bank that, you would go to open a checking account. It's really what is often referred to as a banker's bank, and it partners with local community banks to, and in some cases credit unions, to expand their lending capacity. So a community bank might have someone, a business, approach them for, say, a $400,000 loan, and the community bank would evaluate that loan, and if they thought it was a good opportunity, maybe they would provide half the money, and the Bank of North Dakota would step in and provide the other half. And so what it does is it enables all of the state's community banks to make more loans and to be more active in financing the local economy. As a result of that model, North Dakota has more community banks per capita than any other state in the country, and there are a number of reasons why their economy has been more healthy than other states, but the Bank of North Dakota is one of those reasons. Another benefit of it is it's the bank that the state of North Dakota puts all of its deposits into. So that's where the state of North Dakota does its banking, and that's the source of its the bank's deposits. The state of North Dakota also gets the profits that the bank makes come back into the general fund, and they, on average, have had about $30 million a year over the last decade in profit from the Bank of North Dakota going to, fund state services and state activities.
Well, I can see the argument against it. I mean, you certainly make a case for it. The argument against it might be that you've got the state of North Dakota competing against commercial banks. This is, you know, you're interfering with the market here.
Well, it's interesting because it's certainly not competing with local banks. You know, as I said, it's really enlarging actually their ability. You know, local banks that maybe would have been too small, say you've got a business customer that's growing, and they now need larger and larger size loans or credit lines, you know, local bank may be outgrown in its ability to do that, but because of the Bank of North Dakota, they now are able to do that. I think it's a very prudent financial model, and it really goes back to the 1920s when the farmers and the small businesses in North Dakota were really being squeezed by these big out-of-state banks based in New York and Chicago. And they said, you know, we really need to have that kind of financial capacity here locally. And, you know, in some ways, I think, you know, a lot of the country is really in that situation right now. We need to bring some of this financial capacity back to our own communities and our own states for the benefit of our own economies.
Well, Randy Chambers at Self-Help, is this the answer? Can we, and I think you might have to put aside for a second the current assumption, the economic assumption of, you know, of continuing growth, 3-4% growth every year. Is this a model? Is it possible to finance an economy based on nonprofit credit unions and state banks? Could we convert to that kind of system?
I think both what Stacy and April have described is that there's not a one size or one single solution. We don't want an economy where we have only four banks in America that control all of the deposits and all of the lending. On the other hand, if you're a person who works in Charlotte and travels regularly to New York City and are tending for an ailing parent in San Francisco, and you're a person who likes to walk into a bank branch, it's actually pretty nice that there are two or three banks that have a branch in each one of those cities. On the other hand, if you limit your radius to Durham, North Carolina, then it may not make sense for you to be at a big bank. Or as April described, if you're not able to get a loan from a big bank, the fact that there's a well-run state-funded agency like the North Carolina Rural Center that is available to make a loan to you, I think is really good. So I think in some ways that what we really want to have is we want to have a diversity of options both for the consumer and so that there's some, you know, regulatory differences between what folks do. I think Stacy mentioned, you know, that most credit unions tend to focus in the consumer market, small loans for cars, personal use, and a mortgage or a home equity line of credit. Our credit union is a little different. We do a lot of lending to businesses and nonprofits. But in most communities, credit unions aren't the dominant business lender. So you want to have somebody like a community bank to make business loans. So really what you need, I think, is an abundance of choices. And you also need transparency. The consumer needs to know what they're getting. And I think what this movement is really about is about transparency. Just like you know, table grapes in the 1960s, the understanding that you were buying table grapes that were being sprayed with pesticides that were harmful to farm workers, or that your pension fund might be funding investments in South Africa in the 80s. I think now what people are saying is, I want to know what my money's being used for and not just how you're going to treat me as a customer, because I can probably evaluate that, although in many ways banks haven't been very transparent there either. But not only how you impact me as a customer, but how are you impacting my local community environmentally and economically?
People do seem to be becoming aware of that. There is a movement now to put pressure on banks and on politicians to make some changes. And part of that movement is to urge people to move their money out of big commercial banks. But if that happens, Stacy Mitchell, I mean, that you can't just close your account and dump it all into Self-Help or Coastal or Latino Credit Union. You got to do something else. And I know you've got some recommendations for what you would do and how you would actually make that transfer if you decide to make the move.
Yeah, so you do need to, you know, I should say that many credit unions and local banks have sort of kits to help you through the process, because it is a little more complicated than just, say, switching grocery stores. But you need to find a bank or credit union that's going to work for you, and then open an account there and begin to make transfers in terms of moving. If you have your paycheck deposited automatically, you need to have that switch to the new account. If you have automatic withdrawals, you need to switch those. And again, many banks and credit unions have, you know, generic forms that you can use to make all those things happen. And for a little while, It's a little tricky, but for a few weeks at least, you need to try to keep some money in the old account until you make sure everything has cleared. And then the other thing that's important to note is you want to make sure that you actually go in and close that account. Don't just bring it down to zero, because what you may find is that the bank will charge you a fee of some sort for not having a balance if it's still technically open, even if you don't have any money in your account.
And Randy, not all services are the same, so you might really check into. Self-help doesn't offer all the same services as maybe your commercial bank. You need to find out what you have and what you don't, what you charge for and what you don't.
I think that's right. The consumer needs to know what they want. Do they want online bill pay? Do they use branches a lot? You need to know whether they can do that. I think the other thing is to question the bank about some of its practices. You know, do they do repetitive overdraft fees where they charge you $30 every time you overdraw your account and still honor the item? Do they do overdraft on debit cards? Bank of America and Citibank, for example, are two national banks that if you go to a merchant and swipe your card and try to buy something that costs $20 and you only got $5 in your account, they reject the transaction, which I think 80% of consumers in a recent survey indicated that's what they'd prefer to do rather than actually paying for something that they can't afford to buy. So it's not just, I think, a question of what you need to ask, what do I need? Do I need online banking? Do I need branches? Do I need ATMs? But then also, what sort of fees are going to be hit on my account? What sort of things do you do with my money?
And sticking with just that one example, overdraft protection sounds like a service, but it can become a kind of payday loan in a sense.
That's right. I mean, I think the data shows that somewhere around 12 or 13 is the average number of overdrafts that someone who uses overdraft protection every year is hit with, which, you know, adds up to $500 or more in fees for that person. Plus, they get trapped in a debt cycle where for 90 days or 180 days, they owe the bank money and keep getting assessed. So I think, you know, getting an understanding of what the bank is going to charge you to access your money, whether they offer an overdraft line of credit instead of a fee-based overdraft, whether they offer – banks are now moving into payday lending directly in some cases where they do a loan against your direct deposit, even if it's a Social Security check, where they charge you $30 for a 10-day loan. So I think asking how does the bank treat you as a customer and what sort of fees it charges you for its services is another piece that people really should be asking. And really, the banks should be transparent and let you know what those fees are. If it costs $50 a year to offer you a checking account, then it may not be unreasonable for a bank to charge you $5 to do that. But it'd be better to do that than have you hit with some fee, as Stacy described, that you didn't even know about later on.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. My guests are Rick Rothiker, who covers banking for Reuters. He is the author of Banktown, The Rise and Struggles of Charlotte's Big Banks. Stacy Mitchell is a senior researcher with the New Rules Project, a program of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Randy Chambers is president of Self-Help Credit Union. It is based in Durham. Sally Omarova is an assistant professor of law at UNC, who specializes in financial regulations. That's our program for today. As always, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. You can find a link to calendar of events, anything that we've mentioned on the show. Coming up this Friday, November 4th, we are going to be at the Haw River Ballroom in Saxapahaw, and playwright Howard Kraft is going to be with us, as well as some of the cast of Jade City Pharoah. A new radio drama launches on this program featuring a black superhero named Harold M.F. Jones. It's going to premiere on the State of Things very soon. The show, To Get It All Going, happens this Friday, November 4th at the Haw River Ballroom. Live music, Kim Arrington's going to be there, Sherlette Ammons and the Dynamite Brothers, spoken word of the Sacrificial Poets, and we will see the pilot of Jade City Pharoah, all of that performed live at the Haw River Ballroom. Go to hawriverballroom.com or visit our Facebook page to find out more. That's the State of Things for today. Thanks for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.